Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Nigeria has not had a global governance role at this level since 1961 in terms of being able to sit at the highest body for global governance, the Security Council of the United Nations.
Liberia launches a bid for a non-permanent seat in the UN Security Council.
Congo is one of our largest funding sponsors. In 2024, we supported Congo. This was our number one funding response last year. I think this year it's been overtaken by Sudan.
In the DRC, USAID plans to continue providing help to victims of the ongoing conflict in parts of the country's northeast.
As you know, we also published our 2024 Index of Governance, which is assessing the trends in governance over the 54 countries of Africa over the last decade of available data, which in this case is 2014-2023.
And the Mo Ibrahim Foundation releases its latest report on the review of trends and stories on its African Governance Index in 2024. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Liberia's foreign minister says the administration in Monrovia has launched a bid for a non-permanent seat at the United Nations Security Council. Sarah Besolo Nyanti says the move forms part of the effort to garner enough vote to become one of the African countries to be seated at the top UN decision-making body. It comes as members of the African Union called for UN reforms, including the composition of the Security Council. Some Liberians worry that the recent fire that badly damaged the Capitol building could undermine the country's efforts to win a seat at the UN Security Council. For more about Liberia's efforts and the latest political development, I reach Foreign Minister Sarah Besolo Nyanti.
Liberia is vying for the non-permanent seat on the Security Council, one of the African seats, and Liberia is making efforts to ensure that we get the number of votes required to be able to occupy the seat.
How significant will this be for the people of Liberia, where the African countries were to vote for Liberia to have a seat?
This would be very significant because Liberia has not had a global governance role at this level since 1961 in terms of being able to sit at the highest body for global governance, the Security Council of the United Nations. This would be an opportunity for Liberia to share her experiences, an opportunity for Liberia to have the voice to be able to speak to issues that affect many countries around the world as it relates to peace and justice, and ensuring that we can share all of the experiences we have had in terms of conflict, in terms of peace building, and all of the knowledge that we've gained. We have the credibility to sit in the Security Council and be a voice also for the Security Council reform.
I know you are part of the team spearheading this effort, but realistically, what are the chances of Liberia in attaining this?
So one of the things we should mention very importantly is the fact that ECOWAS as a bloc has had a very good cooperation. ECOWAS, we had Guinea-Bissau at our previous ECOWAS meeting in July. Guinea-Bissau indicated their interest in vying for the seat as well. And Nigeria was discussing the possibility of going subsequently. But amongst us, we were able to come to an agreement in July that Liberia will go ahead to vie for the seat for 2026-2027. Guinea-Bissau will go after. And I think that level of cooperation and agreement amongst the ECOWAS countries was fantastic. And so we know that we have the support of ECOWAS. Also in February, we were able to conclude on the support from the African Union for Liberia's bid. And that also gave us a boost. But we know that having the support articulated as a bloc is one thing, but you have to make sure that those who go instead to do the vote actually cast the vote. And so it's a lot of work we need to do to demonstrate that we're going to be a voice for Africa. In the interests of Africa, yes, as a sovereign nation, we carry Liberia's voice will carry Liberia's interests and Liberia's agenda, but we'll also speak for the African bloc as well. And so this is significant.
Madam Foreign Minister, recently the Liberia capital was touched, and a lot of people are expressing concern that looking at the situation, it might even undermine your efforts to gain the seat at the UN Security Council. What is your take on that?
My take is that this even demonstrates even more why Liberia should be on the Security Council, because peace building takes a long time. It takes a generation. And when the Security Council sits to determine what model or what construct a peacekeeping mission or political mission should have in a country that's going through conflict or a country that's fragile or vulnerable, the experiences of Liberia will add value to those conversations, because what we're experiencing today is not an event. It's part of a long history of the conflict we have had, some of the challenges we have had, and we have come out on the other side better and stronger, but yet we still have some challenges that remain. And I would beg to differ and say that these are the reasons why we should be there to talk about the longitudinal approach. The issues we face today with drugs and crime and so forth, are those not a result of some of the challenges we have had in terms of conflict and chaos? We had a peacekeeping mission that is deemed to be a successful one that folded down on mill. However, one would argue that you also had some elements of peacekeeping that didn't work. You know, the DDRR process, the reintegration and rehabilitation that happened with child soldiers, they were not longitudinal, they were not sustained. We have a traumatized population. We have people who still need trauma counseling. We have the effects of war. And so peace building needs to be approached probably differently, and I think the Liberia experience will help to add value to that conversation of what peacekeeping needs to be for countries in conflict, and how we can ensure that they don't return back to chaos, and how we can ensure that we help countries to heal and to have better social cohesion and to have better efforts at reconciliation and so forth. So I think there's a lot you can learn from the Liberian experience, and I think that that gives us more credibility at the table.
Recently, the president disclosed that he received a call from the Millennium Challenge Corporation, or the MCC Compact Grant, for the first time since 2015 that Liberia has qualified. And the report is that it's opening the door to up to a $500 million in U.S. aid. What can you tell me about this?
So what I would say is that we wouldn't want to mention the amounts, because we know an amount for Liberia has not been agreed. We won't know what Liberia will be approved for. But what I can say is that the new compact opens the door for Liberia's development agenda, the arrest agenda of President Boyka, looking at agriculture, rule of law, roads and infrastructure, education, sanitation, tourism. And the first compact that we had was about $257 million, and it really addressed a lot of the issues around access to electricity and roads, but it wasn't sufficient. And I think this opportunity now helps us to look overarchingly, not only at just electricity and roads, but to continue what was being done, build on what was done with the first compact, but then to take it a step further, looking at how we can address climate change and climate smart agriculture, looking at how we can look at green energy and renewable energy and other areas that will help to address some of the basic social service needs that we have. So this is a huge opportunity for Liberia, and this is something that the government is taking very seriously to ensure that we address all of the key priorities that are required for the Liberian people to have a chance at success.
Sarah Baisolo Nyanti is Liberia's foreign minister. She spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the top official in the U.S. Agency for International Development says the organization will continue to provide assistance to those affected by the conflict in parts of the country's northeast. Solani Kodi, the head of the agency's International Development Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance, recently traveled to Eastern DRC to highlight the urgent humanitarian crisis in the region. Among the issues she addressed while in the DRC include food insecurity and gender-based violence. Her call comes as both local and international right groups blame the M23 rebels for scores of civilian deaths and large displacement of unarmed civilians in the northeastern part of the DRC. In a wide-ranging interview with me, Solani Kode echoed feedback from victims of the conflict who, she adds, want the violence to end. Here's part one of the conversation.
I was a frequent visitor to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Eastern Congo back in 2019 when I worked for USAID and helped support and lead the U.S. government's Ebola response back then. So I have not been back to DRC since January 2020. And, you know, the year that I spent a lot of time there, I really grew to love DRC and the people, and was very proud of the U.S. response in partnership with the Congolese government and Congolese NGOs and other partners to really bring Ebola to its knees and basically bring about zero cases. And really, at the time, I had thought in 2019, it felt like such a crisis in North Kivu and Ituri. And I had really hoped that Eastern Congo had recovered from that. So I was very happy and eager to go back this time. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, what I found was a country and a region that is still in crisis, this time a man-made crisis instead of a viral crisis, and was really saddened to see that, you know, the region has taken a step backwards.
Talk to me about the issue of food insecurity while there.
Sure. So, you know, just to give you some numbers, there are 6.9 million people. This is a huge amount of people who are displaced in Congo. And in North Kivu and South Kivu, there's 2.4 million or so people who have been displaced from the M23 crisis alone. And what this basically means is that people have had to leave their homes and their villages and their fields and their gardens and their animals to seek safety and shelter from the violence. And that has created a massive food crisis and food insecurity crisis because people can't rely on their incomes and they're not at home in their fields. But it's also created a massive protection crisis, the scale of which the experts that I spoke to haven't seen before. Unfortunately, Eastern Congo has historically experienced both food insecurity and protection, gender-based violence for years, but this seems to be a new heightened low in the region, where I spoke to several people who are who have been displaced from their homes, and they really have quite harrowing stories of what they're experiencing.
Now, how is the USAID helping to address this challenge?
So thank you for that question. First of all, Congo is one of our largest funding responses. In 2024, we supported Congo. This was our number one funding response last year. I think this year it's been overtaken by Sudan. But we have put in funding to support the displaced populations in the Kivus. We are providing food assistance. In September, 1.3 million people were reached with emergency food rations. And then we're also trying to do what we can for the protection and gender-based violence crisis. And so this is an undercount, but one of our partners was able to provide this kind of support to 393,000 people living in the camps in North Kivu. And I know that we have local partners who are also reaching even more people. Unfortunately, you know, this is just, it's these are large numbers and we're very proud of what we're able to support. But it's not enough. And ultimately, what we need is that this conflict has to end and people need to be able to go back home and rebuild their lives and till their fields and really just go home. The conflict just has to end. That's the only solution.
Solani Kode is the head of the USAID Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. The Mo Ibrahim Foundation has released its latest report on its review of trends and stories, including elections, based on its African Governance Index in 2024. It comes after 12 countries held polls during the year, with the last one, the general election, held in Ghana on December 7th. But four countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, South Sudan, and Guinea-Bissau, postponed their elections. The Mo Ibrahim Foundation's research shows that new leaders in six countries were elected during the year in review. In a 13th election, the self-declared Republic of Somaliland also saw a new leader elected. The region is not recognized as independent and is considered part of Somalia. For more details about the research, I reached Nathalie de la Palme. She is the CEO of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. Here is part one of the conversation.
Well, it was a very heavy, loaded year of elections, because there were 17 scheduled elections, which is quite important and quite unusual. Even in fact, in 2025, we'll have, for the time being, 11 scheduled elections. And there was a lot of elections also all around the world. What happened, the result of this scheduled elections is quite interesting, because out of these 17 scheduled elections, 12 only were held, 4 were postponed, mostly as expected in the coup country, Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, but also in South Sudan, which is still waiting for its election. And out of 12 elections, interestingly, 7 incumbent leaders retained power and 6 new leaders were elected, which is probably one of the most interesting move, I would say, in this 2014 election year, including a transfer of power, which is also very important, which took place in Botswana, in Ghana, in Mauritius, and in Senegal. And the reason we find it interesting is, as one of one member of our Now Generation Network said, this 2024 year, we saw democratic winds of change.
Talking about governance issues as part of the latest research finding, talk to me about governance deteriorations that has been witnessed so far.
As you know, we also published our 2024 Index of Governance, which is assessing the trends in governance over the 54 countries of Africa over the last decade of available data, which in this case is 2014-2023. And the key findings is that governance has declined almost everywhere on the continent. But if we look more closely at these 17 countries under election, or rather the 14 that held election, we can see that indeed in these 17 countries, governance has been declining, and has been declining in most of these countries, apart maybe from Mauritania. Indeed, what's striking is that in Mauritania is one of the very rare countries over the 54 under review where overall governance has been improving actually by more than 4 points, which is quite a lot compared to the continental average, which is only plus 1 point. And as you know, Mauritania elections have been free and fair, have led to good results, haven't been contested. So it does show that when overall governance is faring well, elections can be held peacefully. On the other side, you can see and witness a very strong deterioration, even deterioration that's increasing over the second part of the decade, in the countries, of course, under coup, like Burkina Faso, but also in countries that witnessed the change of power, such as Botswana, Mauritius, and Senegal also, to a lesser extent. Then you can see 2 countries where elections have been very contested or held in difficult conditions, such as Tunisia or more recently Mozambique. All these countries are countries which are characterized by a very bad trend when it comes to overall governance. And of course, when it comes to participation and rule of law.
Nathalie de la Palme is the CEO of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. She spoke with me from the French capital, Paris. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. In Nigeria, a civil society group called the Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project says it is committed to holding the government accountable to voters. Kolawole Oluwadare, the deputy director of SERAP, says the group plans to use available legal and civic tools to pressure the administration in Abuja to do right by the people. It comes as public sector workers and civil society groups express concern about inflation and the prevailing economic conditions. They have called on the government to act to prevent what they say could soon be widespread hunger and insecurity. Kolawole Oluwadare tells me that SERAP is undeterred in its commitment to fight for the rights of Nigerian citizens.
SERAP is committed to our organizational values, principles, and expected outcomes. And so, we will continue to hold the Nigerian government accountable using the various advocacy tools that we've used over the years, which includes, of course, public interest and strategic litigation. Not because we like to go to court, but when we perceive the Nigerian government is not acting in the best interest of the Nigerian people, we will continue to do that. After all, we're in a democracy, and all citizens must participate in a democracy.
Talk about the issue of the standard of living in Nigeria, because a lot of public sector workers have complained that prices of goods and services have gone up. Your reaction to that?
Yes, but it is less of allocation of public resources, but more of the nature of our spending. And that is why with over 30 trillion naira deficit in the 2025 budget submitted to the National Assembly, we are concerned not only about how that deficit is going to be funded, but about how those funds ultimately, whether they are sourced from loans or whether they are sourced locally, are going to be used. And so, which is why our focus has always been to ensure that governance or the cost of providing public services is transparent and each public officer and those decisions that demand are accountable to the people and the very law that guides their activities.
What about the issue of security? Because the government has said security has improved in several parts of the country, although critics say that it is not so, and that these armed groups, including Boko Haram and ISWAP, are still continuing to attack unarmed Nigerians in other parts of the country, including the Northeast.
If government is saying security has improved, perhaps they are comparing some indices that the public do not know about, and perhaps that is relative from the government's point of view. But citizens that have borne the brunt and continue to bear the brunt of insecurity in most parts of Nigeria will tell you that the security situation is still bad. And while government continues to say it has tackled or is still tackling insecurity in Nigeria, there is little confidence that the citizens have in the ability of the Nigerian state to properly secure every Nigerian, particularly in between travels around some of those major roads and hideouts of bandits and non-state actors.
The removal of subsidies, some Nigerians blame to be the cause of the cost of living expenses being expensive in Nigeria. But the government said that those are painful decisions that would have to be taken that will jumpstart the economy, create more jobs for Nigerians to enjoy in the medium to long term. We went to court, and the issue seemed not to have been resolved now.
The matter is still in court. It has been assigned to a judge, but we are yet to get a date for the substantive hearing of the matter. But what we've seen with the Nigerian government, particularly this administration, since the removal of subsidy, is the inability, or perhaps we can call it the unwillingness of government to demonstrate leadership by demonstrating its commitment to limit public spending, frugality. We've seen increase, and that is where it is most sad and concerning, increased allocations to what is seen as not as frivolous spending. The billions of naira allocated for the residence of the vice president, the billions of naira allocated to getting a new presidential gift for the president, all these kinds of spendings demonstrate to Nigeria that whereas we're in dire straits as a nation in terms of our economy, those are the ends of affairs, particularly from the presidency, are not showing that commitment in the way they spend public funds. And that is the major issue. And that is why we've seen also huge sums of money that have been allocated to various palliative programs of government, including the one channeled to the Ministry of Monetary Affairs, but it is not showing, it is not getting to the beneficiaries, because again, in the absence of little transparency and accountability in the expenditure of those funds, most of it ends up in private pockets. And this has also been displayed, exhibited by the latest report of the General Federation.
Kola Wole Oluwadare is the Deputy Director of SERAP. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. In The Gambia, the head of the Edward Francis Small Center for Right and Justice is expressing concern about corruption in public institutions. Madi Jobate also says the use of state institutions, including the police, to crack down on freedom of speech contravenes the constitution. His remarks come as civil society and opposition groups warn police officers not to violate constitutional provisions that guarantee free speech. This as they carry out their mandate to maintain law and order ahead of next year's general election. Madi Jobate, who is also a prominent human rights activist, tells me the police must ensure that those who commit crimes and financial wrongdoing are dealt with according to the law.
Yeah, certainly. And I can tell you that effort by human rights defenders, anti-corruption campaigners and civil society has been going on. I mean, I have established an organization myself for rights and justice. And we have requested, for example, using the access to information law to request for information from 6 public institutions, including the Office of the President, some ministries and some departments and agencies. And none of them, provided the information that is requested, which, according to the law, are not information related to national security or privacy or other information that should be kept away from the public. None of them gave information. Only 2 institutions responded, but only to basically say they are not giving the information. So that for me is stand against accountability, to undermine the efforts of anti-corruption campaigners who want to see that there is transparency and accountability in the system.
Recently, the ECOWAS backed a special tribunal to prosecute those involved in human rights violations during Yahya Jammeh's term, and people are suggesting that the former president himself must be extradited to the Gambia to face trial. How are people reacting to this, and what's your take on it?
Yeah, this is a positive news, I think, for most Gambians, for, most civil society organizations. This is a really positive news. Of course, except for Jammeh supporters who, have called for this decision to be disregarded. So it's positive, and we hope the government will undertake efforts immediately to seek the extradition of Jammeh. In the meantime, the government has established practically all the necessary legal instruments for the setting up of this court. So we have issued a statement as an organization to urge the government to expedite this process in a manner that is inclusive, transparent, and professional, because we need a court that governments must have trust in it and confidence in it, but also to raise concerns that while this is the case, that is, this effort towards creating a special tribunal, at the same time, we are seeing this government, the president, forming an alliance with Jammeh's party, but also having a lot of Jammeh enablers, key enablers in his cabinet, in the parliament, and other across the state. So these are all concerning realities which may undermine the effectiveness at the running establishment of this court.
Madi Jobate is the head of the Edward Francis Small Center for Right and Justice. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. Mozambique's interior minister says more than 20 people have been killed in unrest after the country's top court on Monday confirmed the electoral victory of the long-ruling party Frelimo Party. The decision by the country's constitutional council sparked fresh nationwide protests by opposition groups and their supporters who say the vote was rigged. Interior Minister Pascoal Ronda has said scores of people have been arrested so far and security measures have been tightened across the country. Frelimo has been repeatedly accused by opponents and election observers of rigging votes. It has denied the accusations. For the latest development, I reach independent journalist Bayano Vali in the Mozambican capital, Maputo.
Maputo itself has been relatively calm. What you see are large queues at petrol stations because people are trying to fuel up their cars. So supermarkets are starting to get empty. People are looting warehouses where there's foodstuff and so on and so forth. Then you will not restock the shelves and the larger Maputo, which means to say that if there's no stocking, coming from South Africa, then maybe in the next days we will really run out of food stuff to eat. And, of course, that will imply that, you know, the larger Maputo will have difficulties. And only those who might have foreseen this and bought their foodstuff for Christmas and New Year's Eve and New Year's Day feast are the ones who are likely to be okay.
Why are they so displeased with the Constitutional Court's ruling? What are their major concerns?
The general thinking here is that the independent candidate, Venancio Mondlane, and the party, Podemos, that was supporting him, won this election. Some of us did go around in the night of elections, saw how the results were coming in, and then which were giving a clear victory to Mondlane and Podemos, like in Maputo seat and Maputo province. And so what the Constitutional Court said, rather than do what the protesters would have been saying, go for what they were calling it electoral justice, meaning that they wanted the Constitutional Council to do a vote recount, which did not take place. What the Constitutional Council did was use the result sheets to compare and then draw its own conclusions, so much so that, for example, the Frelimo candidate now proclaimed Mozambican President Daniel Chapo. He had 70-something percent, and now they reduced that to 5%. And then also the ruling party lost 24 seats in various places, including Maputo City. So I think Frelimo are happy that at least they have their majority. So for the people who have been saying enough is enough, the Constitutional Council did not give them a verdict that they could be happy with them. So hence, they went back to the streets. And then, unfortunately, there are some elements which I think there are criminal elements.
Talking about the criminal elements, how did the hardcore prisoners escape from prison? Because some people are suggesting that this appears to be a calculated attempt to undermine the country's peace and security.
For a while now, the security apparatus, that is being the Minister of the Interior, the police commander, have been using the language of urban terrorists, vandals, so on and so forth, even when there were no looting taking place. So I think when you have introduced this criminal element who go on ferrying youth, who can see the heavily intoxicated, and then who incites others to go and loot, you are saying, basically, that look at these protesters, we have been telling you that they're vandals, they're the urban terrorists, so you are trying to undermine the movement.
Bayano Vali is a Mozambican journalist. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. For the latest updates on events in Mozambique, check out voaafrica.com and all our social media. A new report says that media freedoms in Zambia are under attack. The report says more than 60% of people surveyed think that the media cannot operate freely due to frequent instances of harassment and intimidation faced by journalists and bloggers. For VOA, Kathy Short reports from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
The Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, launched its report on December 17th in Zambia's capital, Lusaka. MISA chairperson Lorraine Mwanza said that journalists in Zambia still face censorship and violence in the course of their duties. Both she and the report cited the case of Thomas Ziambo, an investigative journalist who has been arrested three times in the last 13 months for writing stories that Zambian authorities deemed overly critical. Ziambo faces up to 7 years in prison if convicted of charges that include libel and sedition. Ziambo told VOA that he will not stop writing and reporting.
All the three cases, basically, it's a journalist trying to find the answers on behalf of the public. But I'm now in court because instead of the government answering, they've decided to use the police to criminalize journalism and take me to court. So I'm in court with three criminal charges before three different magistrates.
Ziambo's legal trouble started in November 2023 when he was arrested in connection with an article in which he alleged the government institution was renting a property from President Hakainde Hichilema. In August of this year, he was arrested for a 2022 story about an allegedly illegal government purchase of fertilizer. And in October, he was arrested for an article he wrote about food imports. The most recent arrest came hours after President Hichilema promised to uphold press freedom in a speech read on his behalf by chief government spokesperson Cornelius Mwetwa. Joan Chira is the founder of a Zambian media advocacy group, the Free Press Initiative. Chira told VOA she agrees with the findings of the MISA report.
We have seen political party figures still storming radio stations to disturb programming and threaten journalists there. We have seen journalists being detained by the police. We have also seen journalists being lumped with criminal charges just because of what they have written. And our biggest worry right now is what may likely happen as we get closer to the 2026 election.
Chira criticized colonial-era laws being used by authorities against journalists in Zambia. These include criminal defamation, sedition, and state security laws, which Chira says are a hindrance to journalists playing their role as a watchdog on the government. However, at the launch of the MISA report, an official at the Information Ministry, Mumanga Moden Mayembe, argued that the government has not interfered with media freedoms at all. Mayembe said the government has opened up the media space as evidenced by its licensing of more than 200 radio stations, 50 TV stations, and many online platforms.
When platforms are pure, then there will be few people expressing themselves on those platforms. When we just had one TV session, for you to appear on TV, you needed to be a president, you needed to be a vice president, a minister, or at least somebody with a name in society.
However, Mutoki Mumo, the African program coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists, said in a recent statement that the continued harassment of Ziambo paints a stark picture of the emptiness behind the government's pledges to protect journalists. Kathy Short, VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Botswana has been added as a second center after Belgium to verify the origin of rough diamonds meant for export to the Group of Seven or G7 countries. African producers had complained, making Belgium the sole center led to disruptions in the global diamond supply chain as the G7 moved to sanction gems mined in Russia. For viewing, Kodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
A statement by the Office of the President says Botswana has been granted permission to set up a verification center following intensive discussions with the G7 Diamond Technical Team. The announcement comes as President Duma Boko and the Minister of Minerals, Bogolo Genoendo, returned Thursday from a diamond conference in Brussels. Genoendo told State Television it is logical to grant Botswana, the world's second largest producer of diamonds, the right to certify rough stones. She says, as Botswana, we have a track record in verification and certification, together with other countries which are under the Kimberley process. Kinoendo says, Other producing countries like Angola and Namibia should also be recognized as their own outside the G7, not because they have worked on these preparations for the Kimberley process. The Kimberley process is a trade regime that certifies rough diamond exports to prevent conflict diamonds from entering the global market. In an attempt to sanction Russian diamonds, the G7 at the start of the year proposed that all stones destined for export to their member countries be routed through Antwerp, Belgium, to verify their origin. African producers led by Botswana protested, saying the move caused disruptions to the global supply chain due to delays and added costs. Belgian-based diamond industry researcher Hans Miket says the G7's move to add Botswana as a verification center will allow more industry tracking flexibility.
This decision is an important first step to address concerns over disruption in the diamond supply chain. Botswana appears to be something of a test case, with the G7 diamond technical team already explicitly referencing in their announcement also Namibia and Angola as potential future certification nodes. By diversifying the certification points, this approach could establish a more balanced and inclusive framework for the G7 certification scheme, aligning more closely with the global dynamics of the diamond supply chain.
He adds the development will complement the Kimberley process, which has been criticized for failing to do enough to keep out diamonds from conflict zones.
Moreover, it can also help pave the way for stricter controls and higher ethical standards in the diamond sector, particularly as the Kimberley process certification scheme faces increasing criticism for its declining credibility and for its leniency.
Jeff Bamejo, the coordinator of the Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition, says more African diamond producers should be added as verification centers. He argues the addition of only Botswana will not resolve concerns over supply chain disruptions.
This is good, at least for Botswana. But the problem is Botswana is not the only African diamond producing country. I think this doesn't totally solve the problem for other African diamond producing countries. African diamond producing countries are suffering from a problem that they did not create. I think all of this is about tracing Russian diamonds, but this is now another level of verification that is added to African diamond producers.
Botswana's Export Certification Center is expected to be operational early next year. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Choose your partner if you please. Small shackle shack. Ready? Here we go. Here we go. Clap your hands. Clap your hands. Clap your hands. Clap your hands. Stamp your feet. Stamp your feet. Stamp your feet. Stamp your feet. Left hand swinging if you please.
I'm all shackle shackle.
Right hand swinging if you please.
Hey, kekena mukubebe ya chama, na yenga tali balaze, umana
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoy it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Magwill Yabaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, it costs a burning candle nothing to light up another candle. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. I'm going to go.